actively
against
yeah.
the deputies. So, you know, a kind of a suspicious person might say this is a way of making sure the complaints by Quigley don't get into the relevant deputies' files.
Absolutely.
Am I being a little paranoid here, perhaps?
Absolutely. It's the black hole of Richard Quigley complaints, and probably any others that they don't want anybody to find.
That's a very creative approach. Are they maintaining this Richard Quigley file for any complaints they don't want to go to police officers?
Heaven knows. Heaven knows. But at any rate, that's what the judge says. According to county counsel, who came and testified at the hearing, county counsel says that was actually those two declarations were in the internal affairs file of Jason Nielsen. So we have the judge saying they weren't and the county counsel saying they were.
And the declarations stated something to the effect that they felt that Nielsen was lying on this complaint that Quigley filed?
Yes.
So in other words,
they witnessed the lies. They read the report and they had been eyewitnesses to what happened, and they categorically declared under penalty of perjury that the allegations in the police report were lies.
So not only did Danner not find the Quigley complaint, perhaps because they had been siphoned off to the other file, yours and the Quigley.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why your complaint would go in the Quigley file. I guess it's because it was about Quigley.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, again, this unusual status of honorary police officer, honorary deputy. I'm not sure what his position is. I guess he's a sort of honorary scapegoat or honorary dead file. But these other two complaints that were verified didn't go into the Quigley file, but they went into the original file, according to the county council.
According to county council, they were in the original file, in the deputy's file.
And Judge Danner, who was reviewing that original file, was unable to find them. Again, maybe he has some dyslexic problems. Perhaps you could volunteer to assist him.
Well, I am officially calling all of your listeners, anyone who has ever had a case in front of Judge Danner where there has been a pitches motion, every one of them should be reopened at this point, because it's quite clear that Judge Danner has been, finding no complaints where, in fact, there were complaints.
Well, maybe Judge Danner has a problem maybe it's a psychological thing.
Yeah, right.
I mean, we can get some kind of some sort of hug therapy might be appropriate here.
Yeah. Well, there's another interesting thing that's come out as kind of
Before you go on to that, let me emphasize what you're saying. Anybody out there who has had a criminal case where in that case there was a so-called, what we call a pitches motion, a motion to look into the past complaints of a police officer that is there as a witness to determine the credibility of that officer, please give a call to 423-HUFF, 423-4833.
Or go to your attorney, whoever represented you, whether it's a public defender or anybody else, and tell them you want to reopen the case.
That's good, too. I'll pass that information on to you if you want to leave that on the Huff line, any of you callers, potential callers out there. I'll get that on to Kate Wells. I think your number's also in the book, Kate, right?
It is.
W-E-L-L-S?
Under W-E-L-L-S in the attorney section as well as in the business section.
And you were then saying about an additional factor?
Okay, another thing that has come to light as a result of this is the practice of how they receive a complaint at the sheriff's department. When you go to the window at the sheriff's department, you ask for internal affairs, you want to make an internal affairs complaint, they hand you a form, and you believe, we all believe, I believed, I was filing an internal affairs complaint. Well, guess what? You're not.
you're filing an internal affairs complaint? It's just sort of a request.
You're filing what they call a citizen's complaint.
Uh-huh.
Okay. A citizen's complaint goes to, guess who? Sheriff Tracy.
Sheriff Tracy, to determine whether it's a frivolous or false complaint.
Whether or not it rises to the level of an internal affairs complaint.
So perhaps he, Ken McLaughlin, and Mike Rotkin will make that decision together.
Well, when I found this out and I confronted the county council about it, she said, well, we couldn't possibly investigate the volume of complaints that we get.
Whoa, interesting.
And, I just stood there with my mouth open saying, my God, if you're getting that kind of volume of complaints, isn't it a sign that maybe something needs to be done?
Sounds to me like what you need is a Public Records Act request, Kate, to determine just how many complaints are coming in as, quote, citizen complaints.
Right.
My understanding, and I haven't looked at the law, perhaps you have, that there is a state requirement that complaints be pursued through an internal affairs process, whether the chief likes it or not.
I believe there is, and I believe that's going to be part of what we're going to... I, I, we're going to allege something is going to happen here because it's outrageous. And as we speak, this kid sits in jail for 18 months for a charge that basically he should not have been in jail for any more than a year at the maximum.
And that charge is what, resisting arrest?
Yeah, it would be running, like, right. You know, from an officer. Well, I mean, that's a misdemeanor at best.
Wasn't he guilty of something far greater, Kate, which is casting some kind of aspersions on the rather, you know, distinguished judicial robes of Judge Danner and our fine deputy, what's his name again?
Nielsen.
Well, I mean, isn't that really his crime?
It really is despicable what's happened, and I'll say this: I think that when I filed the initial complaint 4 years ago, and Quigley filed his complaint, we got a letter about a week later saying that he'd been exonerated. We weren't called; neither the witnesses were called. So there was no investigation whatsoever, and they exonerated him. Now, he was a rookie at the time he did this.
Deputy Nielsen.
Right, which I find even more actually repulsive because, you know, sometimes after 20 years on the force or something, I guess you could get, you know, kind of jaded, but this was a rookie lying from the beginning to the end of this.
You're talking report. About the original complaint that actually, as I recall, because you talked to me about it at the time, happened in front of your house?
That's right. Happened right in front of my house.
This is not the Pinto thing, which happened 2 or 3 years later.
Right. Now, if Sheriff Tracy or the Internal Affairs Department of the Sheriff's Department had told him in absolutely, you know, categorical terms at that time that we do not countenance lying.
Briefly, what was the complaint about so people could know?
In police reports. I've got a call coming through, so I'll just ignore it. But what's that?
What was that complaint about that you and Richard Quigley made way back in 1998 or so?
Well, it was an incident where he had arrested Quigley on suspicion of being a prowler in the neighborhood, whereas, in fact, he lived here. And the officer lied about several things, including the fact he alleged that Quigley was so intoxicated he couldn't stand up. Quigley hasn't had a drink in, he's a 25-year member of AA and hates people who drink. He said he reeked of alcohol. He obviously did not reek of alcohol. And
you were a witness, so you could smell him too, right?
Well, of course, and as was the clerk in the store, as was the other witness who witnessed the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And he also said that Richard Quigley had refused to identify himself. The clerk in the store confirmed in her sworn declaration that not only did Richard Quigley identify himself when Officer Nielsen asked, that when he did identify himself, when he said, "Yeah, I'm Richard Quigley," that Jason Nielsen responded, "I thought so."
Oh, ho. Well, maybe he had seen the Quigley file.
Yeah. So in his report, he lies. He said that he lies about what I said to him. He lies about what he said to me. The report was lies from the beginning to the end. And the irony of all of it is that there was no need to even file this report. Basically, you know, the incident was over in 15 minutes. The people who had reported the prowler came down and said, "No, that's definitely not him." They let him go, and it was over. So it was gratuitous lies. There was no reason for him to do this.
Well, wasn't he defending his reputation? Didn't he think that Quigley was going to file a complaint, and therefore what he needed to do was...
Yeah, I'm sure that's what he wanted to do, and that's exactly what he did in the Pinto case.
This is a cover story that's held up for 4 years, and apparently it involves going so far as to allow him to shoot another individual...
Exactly.
...and have that individual held in jail for, what, a year and a half?
A year and a half. And
he's still on the force, this guy, right?
Still on the force. Believe me, Quigley and I feel very badly about that, because if we had followed up on that back 4 years ago, this kid might never have been shot.
How do you follow up on that? And that's the next question I was going to ask you. What can people do? We just heard this decision in San Francisco, you know, that seems to say special privileges to our elite police forces.
Yeah.
What can citizens do?
Well, you can sue them. And that's that. And Quigley actually did file suit against him. It's just that he had so many other things on his plate at the time, he let the lawsuit go.
Well, I know that you recently have been kind of helping with this lawsuit by the Fassbinders on my behalf for obstructing the sidewalk downtown. Some would call this rather petty. I mean, here I am, you know, I'm held in handcuffs, taken away, held for, what, an hour or so, and then released. Why am I causing so much trouble? Why is this an important enough case for an attorney to get interested in, other than perhaps making a fee?
Well, it's first of all, the facts are that the amount of hours that they spent surveilling your table, videotaping your political tabling, at a time when our budget is pushed to the hilt, there's no excuse for that kind of behavior on the part of the police department. And you notice that the only budget, I believe, that was increased was the police department budget.
Right, that was true last summer. This year, they're claiming they're going to cut it back, but I haven't seen them do that yet, although
right.
I guess this summer endlessly.
At the expense of all of the other programs that they're cutting.
It will actually cause the need for more police, so we can have a bigger police budget.
Exactly.
If you don't have social services and you don't have a police review, you're going to get more lawsuits, presumably.
Right. And of course, that makes the city attorney happy, because the more lawsuits, the more money they make. And, of course, now John Barrasone's got his wife even on the payroll down there.
How about the gravy train, could you?
Yeah. This is another thing that I'm just outraged about, and that is the fact that by not having an attorney on the payroll for the city, they have Barrasone's office excuse me, works on a contract basis. So that basically they get paid by the hour for the legal work that they do. There is no incentive for them to ever settle a case, because the longer the cases go on, the more money they make. It's not their money. It's the taxpayers' money in the first place, so they don't care. They have admitted to spending more than $500,000 in the Blue Lagoon case when my clients would have settled for somewhere around $10,000 and an apology initially.
Quick summary of the Blue Lagoon situation.
Well, allegations are police harassment, which became got to such a fever pitch that the Blue Lagoon lost an incredible amount of business. They were bringing their canine into the bar. Uniformed officers were coming and sitting in the bar for hours at a time when there was nothing happening. They were stationing their police cars across from the Blue Lagoon in the Metro parking lot, where they would park four abreast with their lights on, their bright lights on, shining on the Blue Lagoon. And basically people stopped going there because of the constant police harassment. So we brought a suit against them. One of the instances of the incredible abuse of what they're, how they're supporting this case is that they hired some expert, financial expert from L.A., because one of the allegations, of course, is that we have lost money in this situation. The Blue Lagoon has lost business and money. And they paid this expert $50,000. $50,000. And when the expert's report came through, it turns out that their expert thinks we lost more money than our expert thinks we lost.
Oh, well, you always should give him no kickbacks involved.
We're going to use him. We're going to use their expert.
So what's the situation for the Blue Lagoon now? Are they still suffering police harassment, or have the police backed off?
No. The day we filed suit, they backed off, and everything has been fine since.
So, in other words, the lawsuit did seem to have a positive effect.
Absolutely. It has had a positive effect, and we're due to go to trial sometime this year. It hasn't been set, so...
You know, in 1994, you were instrumental, along with attorneys Margaret Marr and, I guess, Isabel Gilman and Valerie McGuire, others from the what I thought was a local ACLU, in defending, well, first of all, testifying against the proposed downtown forbidden zone ordinances that criminalized people for essentially innocent behavior if they're within 6 feet or 10 feet of a building, like sitting or spare changing or having a table or performing on a musical instrument. There was a lot of public testimony and a lot of opposition. And then, you and others supported legal challenges to the law, and actually you got every single one of those defendants was found not guilty, including Linda Edwards. I'm sorry, go ahead.
That's right.
And including, I guess there were 39 people arrested for sitting on the sidewalk after the police did this mass action against Food Not Bombs on May 11th of 1994. Yet this year, not one attorney, I'm not criticizing you, but not one social service provider, and not one legal challenge has showed up around this law. What kind of times are we experiencing that has led to this? Or are attorneys now kind of, are they intimidated? Are they overworked? Are they of the view it's useless? Have they all left town? What's your sense of this?
Well, they've made it so difficult. The courts are the last piece to the puzzle. We've lost the courts. The courts are broken. We have people like Judge Danner in there who you know, really doesn't care about what the law says. He only cares about what, you know, what the government wants him to do. The courts have become so politicized, it's outrageous. An example of that is probably the Ninth Circuit decision on the Pledge of Allegiance, wherein they found that the under God portion of that pledge is unconstitutional, which was, of course, the right decision, and every constitutional scholar agrees that that was the right decision. Then there was the public hue and cry that went out about their finding, at which point they reversed themselves. Now, if that's not a political decision, I don't know what is. I mean,
well, ironically, the words "under God" only showed up, what, in 1954 or something?
Eisenhower. Eisenhower, yeah.
Yeah.
Everyone has to realize that the whole purpose, or the main purpose of our courts, is to protect the minority against the tyranny of the majority. That is, in other words, if we all decided that we wanted slavery, the court's there to say, no, I don't care if you all want slavery, that's not constitutional. So by the fact that they have reversed themselves, they have submitted to public pressure, submitted to public political pressure, and by the way, the Ninth Circuit is the only circuit that actually has put out some really good decisions. But of course the future is bleak, because there are a huge number of openings for federal judges, and now that the Republicans have a majority, Bush is going to be in a position to name hundreds and hundreds of federal judges. This is the important district court judges. These are the trial court level federal judges who are going to be making the majority of the decisions, and these guys are appointed for life.
And you're making plans to head for Costa Rica?
And I'm making plans to go, well, it's Costa Rica, Mexico, Canada, I don't know.
I think you got better judges there, I don't know.
Because I am quite clearly fit in several categories that are suspect as terrorist groups, you know. I mean,
yet you're being helpful and supportive of my lawsuit, even after I lost. Well, I haven't really lost it, but it was summarily dismissed. The one against the, I call it the Heil Krohn lawsuit, where council, Fuhrer Krohn. No, it was Mayor Krohn had me arrested for raising my hands in a mock Nazi salute after he had cut off a speaker, Susan Zeman.
Well, I think everybody needs to reflect for a moment on the years preceding Nazi Germany, and realize that we're there. We're on our way in a downhill slide that I don't know if anybody can stop it short of bloody revolution. And realized as we look around that under the Terrorist Act, you know, they can seize you, they can keep you from having an attorney, they can hold you with no charges. I mean, you know, we've got to, every one of us right now, look at each other in the eye and say, you know, what am I going to do if they take you away? Because it's happening, and it's happening right here, and it's a pretty frightening thing. I also wanted to call attention to a website where you can vote no. It's a referendum where you can vote no on the war.
Okay.
It's called the website is www.votenowar.org.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go on that website, there is a referendum that you can vote no on the war, and just for, you know, whatever.
Well, I know that a lot of people voted no with a phone call to Mayor Riley at 420-5022, because when she called me back on Tuesday, she told me that they were holding a town meeting, as we requested.
Right.
Unfortunately, that would be on February 18th,
see,
probably.
That's another thing. You know, they talk about
well into the bombing.
Yeah, they vote this thing. I mean, you know, they should put their money where their mouth is, you know. They should say, look, at anybody who refuses to go to the war, we'll give you safe haven here in Santa Cruz. You know, I mean, put their money where their mouth is. Do something positive more than just making this stupid vote saying, oh, we, you know, we condemn the Patriot Act, or we condemn this, that, or the other thing. I mean, let's do something positive to show that we really mean that.
That's a good idea. I mean, I'd proposed that we need... I mean, I was glad to hear that she's holding a town hall meeting, but I had suggested it be held 2 months ago when it might have had some significance. It still could, conceivably, if Bush is deterred from an immediate bombing campaign, but it's not clear that he isn't going to start bombing next week.
Yeah, well, we've already divvied up the oil, you know, there, and I mean, we gotta go and get it now, you know, because we've already evidently split it up with England. I can't think of any other reason why Tony Blair would be going against the will of his people, other than the fact that it's going to be a new source of oil for him.
Well, even Blair said today he wanted to give the inspections more time to work, and now it's Colin Powell, who seems to be the war hawk, if you look at the recent online speeches.
I also want to call attention to an article that was in the San Francisco Chronicle back on January 18th, calling our back to the situation in California, and the headline of the article is legislators want an extra $8 million for pay and perks. And I'll just read a little bit of it because it's a pretty outrageous thing, and I can't believe that I haven't heard any kind of a hue and cry or protest as a result. Sacramento. While it contemplates cutting free lunches for the elderly and slashing services for the blind and disabled, the legislature has recommended boosting their own budget by $8 million to pay for its cars, salaries, and catered meals. The state budget plan released last week calls for increases in funding for running the legislature to $200 million, including salaries for 120 lawmakers and their staff. It is one of the few divisions of state government earmarked for an increase by Governor Davis's budget proposal. Let's see, the $220,000 requested by the legislature for catered meals would cover about 40% of a statewide senior lunch program that Davis wants to eliminate in the budget he presented to the legislature. Let's see. Lawmakers requested $78,000 to conduct ceremonies and events, and would spend $1.01 million for studies about issues important to them, $1.27 million for postage, and $1.5 million for car leases, insurance, and oil changes.
Now, wait a minute, Kate. We're protecting the minority, that is to say, the legislature, against the tyranny of the majority. I don't see what your problem is.
I would like to hear, I guess the only thing that bothers me more than what's going on in our government is what's going on with the people. Where are the people? And who is, you know, is anybody out there? Hello? You know, what's happening? I haven't seen a single letter saying this is outrageous, letter to the editor. I haven't seen anything. It just kind of goes, okay, well, business as usual. The other thing is, of course, the prisons. Prisons budget is not going to be cut, and that's because, guess what? You know, the prison guards were one of the biggest donators to Gray Davis's campaign.
Well, we need some place to put the people who are unmannerly, as Mayor Riley or former Mayor Fitzmaurice might put it.
Yeah, those people who grew medical marijuana for medical patients, you know?
Speaking of medical marijuana, you, of course, have talked about this on the air before, and I want to point out that Andrea Tischler will be coming on the air with me on Club Cruise, a television show that airs every Tuesday and Thursday at 7 o'clock. We're going to be talking about her proposal to have a town hall meeting or forum on actually making it legal for people to have medical marijuana in Santa Cruz. Many people out there of the opinion that it's just the feds that are coming down. The good Mayor Crone is distributing marijuana wildly along with Valerie Corral at mass rallies at City Hall. In fact, what's happened is quite the contrary. 13 people got marijuana, or was it 7? I don't know. And only 250 people in Wham have a regular access to marijuana. And of course that can be cut off by the feds. But the city law, put together by Fitzmaurice Rotkin and the city council, as well as Valerie Corral, has excluded clubs like your club, Santa Cruz Cannabis Pharmaceuticals, from operating. And I guess Andrea wants to do something about that. And I guess I've heard other activists like Theodora Carey and, who does the MedX?
Anita Elliott.
Who?
Anita Elliott.
Oh, Anita Henry?
I mean, Anita Henry. Why did I say?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that there's an interest in changing this. Are you going to be a part of this forum if it comes about?
Oh, absolutely. I would love to do. I mean, I've been anxious to help out all along, but they have chosen not to consult me in any way, even though I have been involved, since the beginning. It's just. Well, it's interesting because I have a friend up in Placer County who was the editor of the Auburn Journal, which is the Placer County newspaper. And he was doing several favorable articles about our lawsuits up there against this nasty stormtroopers who have been, going into people's homes and handcuffing parents in front of their children. All of the cases were dismissed for medical purposes. At any rate, after he'd written a few favorable articles, he was summarily called on the carpet by the owner of the newspaper and told that he would not write any more articles about it, at which point he quit and has devoted his life for the last year to writing a book about the coalition of law enforcement and California state officials to subvert and undermine Prop 215. They have done everything they can, and that started with Lundgren, but of course it's continued under Lockyer, to cooperate with the federal government to undermine Prop 215. And in writing this book, he has done a Freedom of Information Act request and gotten amazing documents where the sheriff, for instance, up in, I think it's Yuba County, I'm not sure where they court-ordered her to return the marijuana. She wrote a letter to Ashcroft and to Hutchinson saying, what am I supposed to do? I don't want to be in opposition to federal law here. And they wrote back to her saying, well, just get in touch with us and we'll come in and take care of it. Well, this is an outrage. This is treason. And I will say that publicly, and I will back it up with every bit of might that I have. California has a constitution, and California has a Article 3, Section 3.5. You can all look it up. It says categorically that state officials and law enforcement shall enforce California state law unless and until it has been overturned by an appellate-level court or higher. Prop 215 has not been overturned by any appellate court. Oh, and I left out a little portion of that. Even if the law conflicts with federal law, it says it categorically in there. If there's a conflict between state law and federal law, you will enforce the state law.
Even though, federal courts are, I might even say, aren't state courts not allowed to use the necessity defense, or are they allowed?
No. That had to do with just the Oakland Cannabis Club, and it has to do with distribution of marijuana on a large scale. They tried to get caregiver status as a club, and it has nothing to do with people keep pointing to that decision, but it basically applies to the Oakland Club and any club like it. Says that the club can't use the necessity defense.
But individuals still can. In fact, I heard on the street...
There's no ruling that they can't.
And on the street today, or actually several days ago, I ran into an African-American guy who told me his... I guess he had a number of... 5 pounds of marijuana was confiscated in this last summer, shortly after Crone's Marijuana Jamboree, where... And it was done by sheriff. I think it was done by city police or Tracy, the head of the sheriff's department.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all returned to him, of course, unusable.
Moldy.
4 months later, moldy.
Yeah.
And so
Tim Allen, I think, said, "Well, you know, that we're not, we aren't expected to be the keepers of this and keep it in good condition." You know, I mean, you know, imagine if that was someone, if that was a diabetic's insulin. You know, I mean, that's what we're talking about.
Plus,
here.
The cost of marijuana, which is more costly than gold these days. We're talking about tens of thousands of dollars of damages.
Absolutely.
Which apparently, well, of course, it's a billion-dollar business, the drug war, for law enforcement agencies, for government agencies generally. You know, the war on terror is only the latest wrinkle or the latest shadow or the
and
latest deprivation.
And they've managed to incorporate it into the war on terrorism as well. It's insane. I mean... any fool can see that if 70 to 80% of what goes through the courts is drug-related crime, then what are we going to do, my God, if we legalize drugs and that 70% of the crime goes away?
There is some positive stuff coming out of Mexico, coming out of Canada, coming out of South American countries who are... There's been some regime changes down there that I think many of us would like, and I think Bush doesn't like.
Mm-hmm.
We had heard you on KSCO recently on Richard Quigley's show. Does he have a show, or is he still being...
No, they're having guest hosts for that spot, the noon news spot.
Well, we're talking with attorney Kate Wells, who is good enough to interrupt her sports day.
Go Raiders!
This is the big day for some of you sports fans out there. Luckily, my show will be off by the time the big game begins. So again, Kate is looking for anyone who's had who's been involved in a criminal case involving a pitchess motion, a motion that asks for the judge to look at the records of police officers to determine if there's been misconduct.
And anyone who's had a negative experience with Officer Jason Nielsen.
And Deputy Jeff Jason Nielsen of the Santa Cruz Sheriff's Department.
Right.
Kate, thank you very much for being with
no
us.
Problem.
Anything you want to add before we...
Thanks for letting me get a lot off my chest.
Thanks for telling us
okay.
where it's at.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And lines are now open. You can contact Free Radio Santa Cruz and actually the world, in that part of it that's listening, at 427-3772. 427-FRSC is the call-in phone number if you want to join us. The war, of course, is something that we're really not talking about. It's the big elephant in the backyard. I'm going to kind of bring that subject back again by playing a bit more of my interviews, or commentary, I should say, from the January 18th mega rally in San Francisco, the biggest rally in decades. Several hundred thousand, some say, at least 125,000, I think, is now agreed against the war in Iraq. That, of course, the war in Iraq has been going on for a decade. The sanctions, the bombing, the no-fly zones, the starvation of children, the denial of medical equipment and medical supplies. And, of course, today the paper reports about a convoy to Baghdad as human shields that's being launched from London. It's sort of a disparaging story. But I think Kate Wells' proposal that the city declare this a sanctuary for all who don't want to fight the war in Iraq is a great idea. See if our great peacenik Scott Kennedy would approve of something. Kennedy's the same man who wants to defang the selective enforcement proposal of Sherry Connable. I had intended to play... In fact, that's probably what I should do. I had intended to play at least selections from Talk About, a Talk About show where Sherry Connable and Mark Halfmoon, chair of the Citizens Police Review Board, such as it was, and I guess it's still theoretically in existence for a couple months, spoke about the issue of this selective enforcement resolution that Sherry brought up. And I think I am going to, before I get to the war, and I'll be doing a little bit of the interviews from the war, the anti-war rally. I'm going to play a bit of that Talk About, and I apologize to people who are waiting to hear the this is kind of a rebroadcast of Talk About. It was done on Michael Sammet's show, and that happens every Wednesday on KZSC, for those of you who are interested, from, I think it's 7 to 8:30 on KZSC-FM. It's at the extreme left end of the radio dial. And there's some good talk stuff in the evening, though often, this was an exception, not enough local to please me. This apparently is, and I'm glad that Sherry and Mark got on the line. And let's hear some of what they had to say.
No matter where I roam, well, we know every single soul is a home. It's written on the back of God's hand. I want to show you something beautiful.
We could spend all night listening to that one.
That
Michael
great.
Franti and Spearhead there. That seemed to kind of hit the nail on the head. I when I walk around downtown, I think about that.
Mm-hmm.
Every person you run into is a poem written on the back of God's hand.
That's gorgeous.
They just have a chance.
And sometimes they don't rhyme.
Yeah, the economic can be demonic. There's some demons, too. Anyway, I'd like to welcome to the KZSC studios Sherry Connable, a local activist, and Mark Halfmoon, chair of the Citizens Police Review Board of the City of Santa Cruz.
Thank you.
And you wonderful folks have been busy over the holiday season drafting a resolution to be presented for adoption to the Santa Cruz City Council, and hopefully that will happen on January 14th. The Citizens Police Review Board has already adopted the resolution for reaffirming the commitment to non-discrimination, especially in the downtown area, but all over, and we can talk about the larger issues too. So why do we need something like this? Aren't we already covered? Don't we have rights?
Well, I think some of the people who have responded to this have said that it's a sad statement that this is something that we need to reaffirm, but I think it is something that the city needs to reaffirm. Last summer in particular, some people who have been involved with the needs and rights of homeless people came to the Police Review Board and asked the board to hold a special hearing about the issue of selective enforcement of the law, which is when some kinds of people or groups of people are targeted for law enforcement while other people who break the same laws are left alone. And the review board decided to hold that hearing. They held that in October, and a lot of people came forward and talked about issues throughout the city, not just downtown,
right,
but many ways in which laws are selectively enforced against people of color, against gays and lesbians, against youth. But it's been particularly dramatic in the downtown area and very noticeable, of course, in this whole struggle over the revision of the downtown ordinances.
Socioeconomic profiling.
Yeah, and one of the things the board had asked for was specific suggestions on that evening of the hearing about what they could do, you know, what kind of action could come out of that hearing. And I had been thinking for a long time about the need in the city to make a strong statement of commitment opposing selective enforcement of the law as a community and as a budget issue, that we wouldn't be spending our tax dollars to support that kind of activity. And so just kind of on the spur of the moment and really in a kind of short period of time, this resolution kind of came through me as something to present to the board as a possible action they could take. And I think it really resonated with the board members, and they decided to move forward with them.
And of course, this is all against the context of the city looking at other resolutions and working with police and trying to figure out a way of handling the crisis situation down there, and wondering what to do. And of course, their answer, you know, was ordinances saying where you can stand and where you can't stand, and trying to be detailed about what you can and can't do, right? Mm-hmm. And so,
that's
and
right.
Of course, the question, there's always the gray area about, you know, and who can do it, and then who's going to enforce that, and will they do that with everybody? And it's like, well, no, you know, the guy with the accordion, who everyone loves, they're not going to touch him, and if, you know, and somebody else, now they're just going to get these other guys. You know, I mean, that was, so the selective enforcement was always a big question,
mm-hmm.
and especially if you're vague, throwing out, you know, well, the police will know what to do, they'll do the right thing, you know, throwing out vague laws that couldn't even possibly be you know, enforced properly, and giving them all the power, and then letting their discretion,
mm-hmm.
right? Discretion seems to be a big word.
Exactly.
Decide the issue. You know, kind of, and of course we're mirroring that you know, with the Homeland Security Act and the Patriot Act, I mean, this is what's happening, is that all the legal power is going to the authorities, and they can use their discretion. The same with the three strikes. The whole three strikes thing was was with the discretion of the district attorney to whether they wanted to lock up somebody for 50 years for stealing golf clubs or not. They didn't have to, but they had the power, and they had all the power, and it was at their discretion who they wanted to lock up for 50 years for stealing the golf club.
What I wanted to say was when we held that meeting in October, the meeting where it was somewhat of a public hearing, where we had people from all over the community, particularly people concerned about enforcement of the law, selective enforcement of the law, downtown Santa Cruz. We've, at least since last January, have been hearing reports and getting requests, and we received letters from community organizations, the Citizens Police Review Board, the CPRB, received letters from organizations, and also about close to 500 signatures on a petition from people who wanted the voices of to be heard, of people who felt like they were victims of selective enforcement.
Right.
And so...
The whole farmer's market.
Right. So what came out of that was the hearing where we agreed to put it on the agenda and listen to what the people had to say and just give it an ear. And, of course, we did want to take some kind of action. And when this resolution, when Sherry brought this resolution to the board, we did take it back and study it for a while and talked about it. And I believe it passed unanimously from seven different, seven people, members of the Citizens Police Review Board, and thought that what we should then do is pass it on to the city, to the city council, and ask them to support it also. If you read it, it's a very apple pie, all-American type thing.
Well, let's go ahead. Sherry, you want to take it? You run out of steam, Mark?
You want to read it?
Rest?
I mean, you read it?
Yeah,
read it.
No, let's
read it as it was.
Yeah.
As it was.
Whereas.
As it came through.
Sure.
From the spirits. Whereas the city of Santa Cruz is a community that welcomes and celebrates diversity, and whereas the city of Santa Cruz is a community committed to treating all people with dignity and respect, and whereas the city of Santa Cruz is a community that believes deeply in the principles of fair and equal treatment under the law and of liberty and justice for all, and whereas the city of Santa Cruz is a community that will not tolerate discrimination in any form against any class of people, and whereas selective enforcement of the law, whether local, state, or federal, that targets certain groups of people is a form of discrimination that has enormously destructive and unfair consequences, and whereas selective enforcement of the law, whether local, state, or federal, in fact denies the sacred principles of liberty and justice for all and of fair and equal treatment under the law, now therefore be it resolved that the city of Santa Cruz reaffirms its commitment to non-discrimination in any form against any individual or group of people based on race, color, national origin, religion, creed, gender, sexual orientation, age, economic status, appearance, lifestyle choices, or any other class-based category, and that therefore the city of Santa Cruz resolves that selective enforcement of the law, whether local, state, or federal, against any such individual or group of people will not be tolerated, nor will any city funds be spent to support such enforcement, and furthermore that the city of Santa Cruz resolves to fully honor in all ways possible the inviolable principle of non-discrimination with fair and equal treatment under the law and liberty and justice for all.
Yay.
I mean,
liberty and justice for all.
Makes you want to stand up and salute or something.
And one of the things about this that there's a activist downtown who's been homeless much of his life. His name's Brian Kepke. And he stepped forward to the microphone, and one of the things he said that was most moving to me, because I didn't really know how people were going to respond, was that he said he really feels as a homeless person that he suffers many kinds of discrimination from the general public and also from law enforcement officials, and that there's nothing in the body of legal language that protects him and that protects homeless people as a class. And then in listening to this, he felt like this began to describe some of what's true about him that would begin to give him protection under the law. And that was particularly what I was, one of the things I was looking for was to bring into the language of non-discrimination language that would protect homeless people, like economic status and appearance and lifestyle choices. And that traditionally has not been a part of non-discrimination language.
Yeah. And there are a couple factors here at work, which obviously you know, come forward in this. And one is this issue, and the people behind a lot of the downtown ordinances are the Chamber of Commerce, the Downtown Association.
Yeah, merchants.
Of merchants of business. So it's a group of merchants that feel that the scene downtown is keeping shoppers out and keeping them from being able to run their businesses properly. And so those people need to be dealt with or put in a place or moved along or whatever it takes for them, for the shoppers to be able to move freely up and down the street so that they can shop as they like. Mm-hmm. And that's it. And so in a sense, it's, you know, curtailing the rights of people who are hanging out down there in order to let the rights of the people who are busy shopping, you know, have their right to shop in a way. I don't think that's a crazy assessment. And so, if you did look at it rather cynically, I mean, you were saying you could look at it in a way that the rights of people with money who are coming down to spend money and therefore get taxed and...
any major enforcement push.
And the ordinances are still rather vague and coming up for review on the 14th. Also, so the process is still hanging.
There's two different sets of ordinances. One set of ordinances has gone into effect that mostly dealt with issues of panhandling, where you can sit on the sidewalk or not sit on the sidewalk, where you can place your belongings on the sidewalk. Those are already in effect, and there's been waves of more aggressive enforcement of those, depending on what's happening and who's complaining. But there have definitely been waves where we've seen a lot of enforcement. With the performers, that is still in process. The second reading of the current version of the resolution will come up next week on January 14th. And I think performers would definitely say that since last summer, when the council made the directive to the police department and the host to... I think they said aggressively or strictly enforce all existing laws. There's been much more enforcement with regard to performers downtown. They've really felt the heat. There are definitely people who are no longer performing downtown because of it.
There seems to be less music.
There's definitely less music downtown. I talked to a wonderful Celtic harpist this weekend who no longer performs downtown.
Yeah,
and he won't perform downtown because he's gotten so many tickets. They really feel singled out. They really feel like they're under the gun.
He used to just do it for the love of it because he loves it. I know
him. And beautiful sacred music.
He makes really good money in other towns over the hill in Monterey. And he would pay his bills and then just come to Santa Cruz just because he loved it and it was a great place to play.
Yeah. And remember,
it's been sad.
How many more people like that?
The old Cooper House, where there was music all the time at the Cooper House, the old Cooper House when there was a band that played there and people would dance out on the sidewalk.
Mm-hmm.
And there was nothing enforced. The sidewalk would be blocked. And remember, there were also people like the Flying Karamazov Brothers, the Screaming Mimis, Tom Noddy, even Barry Public Theater from the 70s and 80s who performed on the streets. And people, and even in one of the convention and visitors council's videos that promote the city, one of their scenes shows the color of the local community. You see a musician.
Yeah.
And that was part of the attraction. People don't come to downtown Santa Cruz to have an indoor mall experience, a squeaky clean experience. I mean, I think people who come to visit this town and walk down that street, well, they're expecting to see something that they don't see at home.
Yeah, and instead we have the O'Neills, which is, our fourth O'Neills in town. And, of course, it was badly needed because of a few things that the Pacific Wave didn't carry across the street that O'Neill's did carry. So that was it was really important to put that O'Neill's right there. right? Is what I have a thinking? I mean, there was a line of sandals, I think, that the Pacific Wave didn't carry that that O'Neill's did. And along that same line, really, to look at what is going on downtown and to look at the gaps of who has moved in and who stayed there. Now we have two gaps.
Who's moved out.
And we have the borders, and nobody's gone into Palookaville, and the warehouse has gone out, and now Eclectics is gone, and ID is gone. I mean, these are just huge holes, and it can't, of course that can't be blamed on people hanging out. I mean, that's the economy, stupid, you know. And and so it's almost like, you know, they tried a vision of Santa Cruz, which would be, you know, large chains and the movies and the up-and-coming, clean, happy, preppy people, you know, and that obviously couldn't carry it, you know. And the people that have come in, if you look at the last four or five businesses, and we would go with Kincaid here under that, and we look at four or five women's boutiques, high-end women's boutiques, of Jade and Rouge, Pacific Trading Company doubling their size, mm-hmm. Dolce Gabbana, whatever. I mean, that's five high-end women's boutiques, and the muffin, the crazy clean,
you know,
what is it, muffin shop down there?
Also,
I mean, all this is very... very bourgeois.
And if you look at the
people who work in there,
I don't know what they're making, but I can bet that most of the people working in a lot of these shops, and I have nothing against them, a lot of them are making minimum wage probably, mm-hmm. and maybe many of them are students. But it appears to me, after being in other areas like Berkeley and the Bay Area, coming here, you go into each of these shops, and almost every single one of them has the same young blonde teenager with her belly button out, and God bless them, I have nothing against them.
Yeah.
But... and I'll go out to some, this is the ironic thing, I'll go out someplace like, if I go out to Costco, and I've gone out there with someone, I don't have a card, but I said, God, I didn't know there was that many people of color, I didn't know there was that many African-American people around here, I see them shopping there, I see them working there, and because I was asking about a job for another young person, yeah. I was asking them, you know, how does it work, and they, yeah. you know, they're offered, some of them are offered benefits and things yeah. like that, and I'm going, well,
and a big sign about how much money they put into the local schools. I mean, everything's made from China, and it's all crap.
Yeah,
and you could
right.
everything is made from China, and it's all crap. But you know, after that, they do a decent job. I mean, yeah. you're right. I mean, it's a good point to make.
Yeah.
It is. It's and you know, I'm not a cheerleader for corporate America, but it appears to me that when you start saying that the reason why we can't be successful in our businesses is because we have undesirable-looking people who are driving away our high volume of sales because people are afraid to come down there, well, you know, I think that you have to really look at the problem. I think the problems that a lot of businesses are having are the same problems many of the residents are having. Our rents are very high, and the cost of housing and the cost of the rents on Pacific Avenue of those businesses are very high, and they're skyrocketed. And so, therefore, merchants, I believe, feel pressured to make more and more money, and therefore they want high volume of sales.
And I think people down there are a scapegoat. I mean, really,
totally.
I think
totally.
No
that's what
down
I
down.
That's what
yeah.
I was going to say, Michael. I've been here for 25 years in Santa Cruz, and you know, every time there's any kind of downturn downtown, the street people get blamed.
Yeah.
It's their fault. And
in a little graph where we can see the ordinances and the economy kind of going in the same pattern over
false.
A 20-year period. Yeah.
It's very false. I mean, sometimes I think it's even false by reporting, because Catherine Byers is a good friend of mine. When she was on the city council, they have access to the tax records downtown. And she said they were doing fantastically well. They were doing much better than before the earthquake. I'm downtown a lot. Downtown is packed on the weekends. It's packed at night. It is bustling. You know, and this idea that I'm uncomfortable going downtown because of the kinds of people I see that some people hold. This is what they say, I'm uncomfortable. Well, they may be uncomfortable, but I don't think that's a reason to create public policy targeting those kinds of people. You know, it's because you're uncomfortable. I mean, people were very uncomfortable sitting next to black people at lunch counters, and they believed they had a right not to sit next to them. And you know what? We decided they were wrong.
Yeah.
And I think this is a very similar issue. People do not have a right to feel like on a public street they shouldn't have to be around certain kinds of people unless there's behavior that really, truly...
No, you're right. And there are different people, you know, who get offended by other different people. I mean, in the way you're talking, most people of color are offended to come down there because it's so bourgeois, I mean,
yeah.
in a sense. And I remember walking with my wife, and she was, you know, we were there on a Friday night, and it was just packed with drunk, you know, mostly drunk young people slurring and grabbing, you know, women and whistling at cars. And, I mean, it was this kind
mm-hmm.
of, you know,
yep.
High schoolish thing. I mean, it happens every weekend, you know. It's
That's
like a
right,
big frat
does.
Party down there, you know,
it
and
does.
It's like, and it was bugging her. And I'm like, well, you know, I mean, there's no ordinance against any of that, you know, and those people actually have some dough, you know, right. They're driving around in their cars, they're looking pretty good, you know, and that was bothering, but it's like, that's kind of, that's what young people do. I mean, that's happening all over the country. That just mirrors all of society. I mean, that's just MTV culture pouring out onto the street. I mean, we're being provocative here, but, you know, this is what we do here, and it's like, that's it. I mean, welcome to the world. You got to deal with it, and you get something out of it, and, you know, go somewhere else. Mm-hmm. Or whatever, or reclaim your streets, whatever you need to do. And you can complain about it, think about it, do the things you can to promote a higher culture, if you like, or more, you know, open and loving, you know, culture. But
I think there's sort of a movement happening, you know, and it's happening on a number of fronts to make certain kinds of people feel unwelcome in Santa Cruz and not want to be here. And the ordinances are one way that's happening. Enforcement is another way that's happening. But there's a whole lot of things going on with parking regulations now, changing the parking regulations.
Again?
Uh-huh. That I believe are targeting.
Yeah, that's a good way to go about it.
Getting rid of the unwanted element.
Because the 6 to 8 o'clock was terrible, and the 3 to 2 hours was terrible.
There's a whole movement now to have all the residential streets downtown be parking by permit only.
For locals.
So you can get a permit if you're a downtown resident.
Listening to a rebroadcast of Talk About with Sherry Connell, Mark Halfmoon, and Michael Sammet.
You know, and the movies, the lines are around the block on all the theaters. The Del Mar's really increased the traffic, and it's the theater goers that really block up, you know, that whole cinema nine just wipes out. No, the cars, it just, you know, everybody's driving to the theater. I don't know, we got kind of far afield here, but I mean, it's interesting to talk, and it all mirrors larger society.
Exactly.
So I mean, this is what's going on everywhere, and you know, when you think about selective enforcement, I mean, the medical marijuana laws are kind of the first thing, you know, kind of comes to my mind as to they can bust you at any, you know, the feds can come in and bust you when they want, and they'll choose when they want, and how they want to do it. Hi, you're on Talk About. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I just wanted to remind you of I guess it was the late 70s, and I think that was the only reason I got into UCSC, because the enrollment was way down, because, you know, Santa Cruz has a bad reputation of mass murders and such. And
after
that
the
time,
Boulder Creek killings and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was at Berkeley, and they were trying to recruit me to come over here in 78 or 79. Or they were trying to pass something where, well, Berkeley...
We're talking about UCSC maybe not being around for a time, a little bit. Like, it was... not going to have enough.
They were going to change. They were going to make UCSC the first 2 years of college, and Berkeley would be the second 2 years of college, because they had nobody at UCSC and tons of people at Berkeley, and they were going to do mandatory forced first 2 years underclass. Yeah.
That was that was when I first came here, and I noticed that was like the toll bashing, and I think the one of the Santa Cruz police officers, I'm not sure, I think somebody died underneath a bridge or something from a beating.
Yeah, they killed a guy.
And
that's right.
The university, the guy got suspended, I believe, and the university immediately hired him. You're one of us, you know. Like, so there was almost a conspiracy agenda that went between the university. I mean, that was how I took it anyway.
Uh-huh.
That
uh-huh.
You know, we got to keep this appealing, so we don't. The demographics, I think, is mostly. You know, there's a lot of young girls from Southern California, and you know, Daddy didn't feel that safe about sending them to Santa Cruz.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember the name they gave to the street people in the 70s? The UTEs.
The Utes.
The undesirable transient element.
Oh right, yeah.
Right. And I remember there was this was a friendly place to come to, and. When I had a more bohemian lifestyle and was traveling around the state and first came here in the mid-70s, someone could come into town, could find a place like the switchboard that the county used to fund, and leave your backpacks or your packages, receive phone calls and messages, have an address, things like that. And I think not because of budget, because of a lot of pressure, the county took the funding away from it.
And that was, I should say, the first half of the Talk About show from a couple weeks back with former Citizens Police Review Board, former chair Mark Halfmoon, and activist Sherry Connable. That show comes on every week, Wednesday nights on KZSC. at 7 o'clock, 7 to 8:30. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. We're going to be playing the last part of that interview probably on Thursday, maybe next Sunday. I do a show twice a week, Thursday 6 to 8 in the evening, and, of course, this Sunday show, 10 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. This is Bathrobes Piers Broadside, Civil Rights here in Santa Cruz. I'm Robert Norris, and the call-in number, if you want to join us for the last 20 minutes of the show, is 427-3772, 427-3772. Looks like somebody does. Hi there, you're on Free Radio.
Hey, Robert, this is Violet.
I'm sorry, say again?
This is Violet.
Hey, Violet.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
I just, I've been listening to you, and I just wanted to say that, that it seems there's that whole ethic about being homeless and being lazy and being poor and being lazy, and if you're not smart, how come you're not rich? You know, if you're smart, how come you're not rich? And there's a bunch of, there are those kinds of, you know, estimations about who a person is by how much money they make, or vice versa. Like you could be totally legitimate part of society making money, doing something entirely useless, like, you know, shuffling real estate around, not producing anything. But as long as you're making a lot of money, then you're really legitimate. And so, like, there is that whole, like, kind of dichotomy about the bum on the rods and the bum on the plush, like that whole kind of thing where we, in our society, and I think that's one of the things that's really playing out. When economy gets low, it's really easy to scapegoat homeless people because you see that, and it's a fear that you have, so unconsciously you want to get rid of it. So there's, I kind of wanted to make that comment. It's like, what is it in the psychology of our society that allows for that kind of thing to happen? You know, like, what kind of things are we internalizing as far as our own worth because of, like, how much money we make, this and that and the other thing.
So
I just kind of want to bring that up.
Wow. No, yeah. It's a good point to bring up. I've actually been reading a book about the history of the homeless in America, and this kind of metaphor or paradigm or perception of mythology that people out there who are poor are bums, necessarily, and that, you know, they are, you know, there was a huge, apparently a huge upsurge of homeless people after the Civil War because of the arrival of the railroad, and
right,
suddenly made everybody mobile.
Right.
And it was regarded as a massive menace and danger, even though there were no, it's like the downtown ordinances were supposedly designed to deal with a menace downtown, although no menace as far as performers, panhandlers, or anything of that sort, which the ordinance actually talks about, actually has ever been demonstrated that I can see in any, you know, clear way. Similarly, and historically, you had a similar kind of, there were actually people who were armed from the Civil War who had, you know, veterans who were without jobs,
right,
blacks who were being prosecuted under the Rising Klan and the destruction of the Reconstruction legislation. Vagrancy laws were actually designed to, particularly in the South, to keep blacks in a state of slavery, to return them to a state of slavery. But the answer to your question, you know, or your response to your comment,
well, it's about economic slavery. We don't have real slavery anymore, but we do, except for the prison system.
I mean, Puritan ethic, too, I think, is some sort of idea that it's, unless you're working very hard, you're not considered to be a worthy person. You know, that's also, I think, part of that thing, plus the sort of, there's a glorification of wealth, although there's a lot of resentment of wealth, too.
Well, I think there's a identification with wealth. There's a schizophrenic split. You can say, you know, that there's a lot of resentment towards wealth because you see a lot of excess, but there's also this idea of, you know, like celebrity worship, which is the worship of wealth.
Right, plus the fantasy that we all can get rich, just go buy a lottery ticket, you know.
Or that we can somehow become president or this or that or the other thing.
Right, or we can be powerful.
Right.
One of the two. Yeah, I think it's... it's bullshit, but it's the same. It's amazing what they sell you. I mean, they sell you the fact that, you know, you have to worry about your underarms, and you have to worry about your hair, and you have all these anxieties are created mainly to sell products. And I guess part of the deal is you keep selling products by persuading people they're, this is just one theory, they're part of this great fantasy of an eternally improving future, which may not have anything to do, actually doesn't seem to have a lot to do with at least what's happening with over the skies of Iraq and what's happening around the seas in Iraq and what's happening in the economy in this country, you know.
Well, there's several delusions at work there. I mean, part of that is because of, like, the whole idea that America is a frontier economy, which is not the case. I mean, we're in California. We've already, like, conquered all the frontier. There's no frontier left. And the whole idea, and we've been, you know, we've been kind of coasting on this great wealth that we've had for over 200 years of these resources.
Right.
And these are coming to a close, have been coming to a close for many, many years, and there's a blindness towards that, that, like, this is going to continue.
What's more than that, it's, you know, all the jobs are going overseas, you know, and the... I guess the way that they're going to continue with the racket is by enslaving the rest of the world, as that's already happened, into providing cheap products for us. And the problem is going to be, how do we separate ourselves from that? And I haven't. I drive a car, you know, I buy all this cheap shit. It says made in China, you know, so I don't know.
Well, I mean, my take on that whole deal is that we are actually superfluous. If we think that we're immune, I mean, that's kind of the problem with selective enforcement, this whole idea that if I'm in a privileged class, then I'm immune. But that's a fallacy. So, like, I can vote to take away somebody else's right. Because if the shit hits the fan, those rights are not going to be mine anymore. I voted away my own rights.
Well, it's, you know, they did that in Germany, and they did that not through dictatorship, but through mass movement. You got to remember, there's maybe a mass psychology here, which people like Wilhelm Reich looked at, the psychoanalyst who analyzed how sexual repression and character armoring maybe behind this strange, you know, submissiveness to authority that we are conditioned into having, even those of us who think we've outrun it, you know, it's, I don't know how deep it is, it's something where they control us with. Maybe there's been some improvements in the last 40 years. I would hope so in some way. I don't know. It looks like it's hard to believe there is, considering, you know, Bush is about to bomb Iraq and Emily Riley's talking about a town hall meeting on February 18th.
Right.
Which is a ways away. Also, people should be aware there's the Citizens Police Review Board. We talked about how its funding was cut on last Tuesday. Well, it is being destroyed itself in 2 days with no notice in the papers. I just happened to log online to look at the agenda, and there is going to be a resolution that, in essence, shuts it down on January 29th. So there goes your so-called, well, it was a fig leaf at best anyway, but there were people there who wanted, as you heard, Mark Half Moon talking, he was the chair of the Police Review Board in the last half hour, wanting to change the selective enforcement downtown. Selective enforcement, if it gets on the agenda at all, and sorry to be talking through your call here, caller, I got about 12 minutes left,
is
going to hit the agenda as a completely emasculated resolution, as Sherry Connable pointed out, by Scott Kennedy, which removes any kind of funding requirement that police stop harassing people just for the hell of it, or selectively, as they put it. I guess, you know, the argument is it's not for the hell of it, it's based on their discretion. This discretionary police state stuff, which is becoming all the rage nationally and locally. Anything more you want to say on what you've been talking about?
I wanted to... That was funny. Your mix of metaphors is Scott Kennedy is a ball breaker. I would think he would be amused to hear that. Anyhow, it would be... I think one of the things that is really important to realize is that in order to turn away from a lot of these systems, what we're going to have to do is organize systems of democratic economy, because our economic scales are far too mixed outside of things that we can control, and we need to keep our resources within our communities. And the only way we're going to fix, you know, homelessness and these kinds of problems is to make sure that there actually is enough for everyone, and then we'll be able to.
Well, there is enough for everyone. It's just some people like to sell it, and some people like to hoard it, and some people want to have much, much more than they need.
Well, sure, that's the case, but that is not going to be. That's something that's going to be a problem that's addressed.
Right.
Through peer pressure or something else like that, that's got to be a local force. It's not something that you're going to be able to police.
I hear you.
So it's going to have to be like something where it's going to have to be something where somebody is going to be able to be trusted and taken in and seen as a relative rather than as an other.
I'm going to have to cut this one off.
Yeah.
Because it is a long conversation. Let's
totally
continue to have it if you want. Six to eight on Thursdays when I come back.
All right. Thanks for being on the air, Robert.
Hey, thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I'm going to talk a little bit about this police review board agenda item. You can go to www.ci.santa-cruz.ca.us, City of Santa Cruz website, and you can find it. It's for on the Tuesday City Council meeting, and the ordinance is, again, on the 7 o'clock session. It is a, let me quickly spin down here. Item number 23, introduction of an ordinance repealing Chapter 2.41 of the Santa Cruz Municipal Code pertaining to the Citizens Police Review Board. Resolution authorizing the city manager to negotiate and execute a professional services agreement in a form approved by the city attorney with a qualified police auditor to review complaints currently pending before the CPRB and to review any future complaints that may be received while the auditor city council model is being developed. Motion to direct that the CPRB suspend its activity effective January 29, 2003. Motion to request that the CPRB members provide input to the Ad Hoc Budget Crisis Committee regarding the development and implementation of the Auditor City Council model of citizen police review oversight. This is all a major sham. The Auditor City Manager Police Review Oversight model costs more than the current Citizens Police Review Board model. So the idea that they're doing this to save money is completely preposterous. It is merely a show, it seems to me, where they're setting up a the appearance of an auditor, but not the actual professional auditor, who would have to be an attorney with a researcher and some kind of investigative staff. Instead, it's just going to be somebody who looks over police review complaints privately in the confines of some office, with the city manager being his boss right there, instead of a so-called independent Citizens Police Review Board, which has never been independent in the sense that it's taken real initiatives, but has begun to move in that direction with, as you've heard, initiatives on selective enforcement, initiatives on display of force policy. That's another thing that came up. When should a police officer, be required to document it when he takes out a baton and threatens someone or takes his pistol out? I would think the average citizen would say yes, there should be a report on that. Chief Belcher says no, not unless there's been an arrest. So you can intimidate people to your heart's content as long as you don't arrest them and as long as they don't complain. And that one has been, that one Belcher has held up on for a year, and I think is the reason that, one of the main reasons that they're trying to kill this board. Third key issue is racial profiling, as well as economic and social profiling, which you heard talked about a little bit. Again, reading a little bit more from the City Council agenda report about the upcoming final execution and beheading of the Police Review Board, coming faster than even I thought. I knew they were defunding it, but I thought they were going to wait till March to completely kill it. Nope, they're going to kill it on Tuesday. Background. As a part of the city's attempt to address a severe budget deficit, the City Council on January 21, 2003 authorized the city manager to take the necessary steps to implement mid-year budget reductions, including the restructuring, oh, what a nice word, of the Citizens Police Review Board. The council further directed that the Ad Hoc Budget Crisis Committee, which, by the way, is not having any public meetings. Note the word ad hoc. That means they can meet in private and in secret. No Brown Act protections. Return with recommendations on how to structure a new auditor city council model of police oversight. That is was being researched by the Citizens Police Review Board itself. They actually called in the auditor from San Jose. But instead of waiting for their report, they took the Belcher road. Chief Belcher is the head of our police force, of essentially eliminating this using the budget as a pretext. No other commissions have been eliminated. And there have been no reductions in the police budget, at least not this time around. This summer, there'll probably be reductions. Discussion. At this time, the Ad Hoc Budget Crisis Committee is recommending... they haven't even had a meeting yet that I can see, although if they have, it was in private without any public notice. This is Kennedy and... I believe it's Kennedy... Kennedy, Riley, and Fitzmaurice are the three people on this committee. The Ad Hoc Budget Crisis Committee is recommending that the first step to implement the mid-year budget reduction be taken by repealing the CPRB ordinance. While the ordinance repeal does not take effect until 30 days after the second reading, March 13, 2003, it is recommended that any outstanding complaints be reviewed by a qualified police auditor. In other words, we don't want you, Mark Half Moon, with your African-American hands on these complaints anymore. The results of the review will then be submitted to the city manager and city council. There are currently three pending citizen complaints and one review. This will allow the budget reductions to be implemented as soon as possible while allowing for the process of existing complaints. What you're going to hear from them is that, well, we've cut the staff, so they can't make up agendas, they can't hold meetings. We killed the board. We pretended we hadn't. Now, in fact, we have to admit that we have, and we're going to send all the paperwork to a person between the city manager's office and the police department. Because there may be some period of time between the time that the existing ordinance is no longer in effect and the specifics of the Auditor City Council Police Oversight Model are developed, approved, and implemented. Notice they've already decided they're going to do this. No public discussion, no examination of alternate models, no determination of whether, in fact, they're even giving you truth in advertising. Since an auditor model, all sources tend to agree in terms of how much it costs. It will cost more. It's not going to be an auditor model. It's going to be, the word auditor is going to be on it, but there's going to be no kind of independent powers as the San Jose auditor has to some extent, although it's got its own problems, that model. The police model site, it is recommended that the contracted police auditor also review future complaints submitted to the city. The outcome of these reviews will also be submitted to the city manager and city council. Further, in order to implement the budget reductions and to transition complaint reviews with the effective date of the proposed ordinance, council needs to direct the CPRB to suspend its activity effective January 29, 2003. This, of course, will stop it from doing any kind of public protest or organizing as a board against this kind of outrageous city council action without any meaningful public discussion, essentially as a backdoor deal with the police department. The council welcomes feedback from existing CPRB members regarding the future of police oversight in Santa Cruz. I wonder if they've even notified them of it. There was only one police review board member at the Tuesday meeting, last Tuesday's meeting. Apparently, they had given the layoff notices to the staff. There were going to be layoffs unless there was some change before they told the CPRB people, and they didn't give the CPRB any time to speak on this issue of any sort in terms of any kind of independent response at the actual Tuesday budget cutting. One CPRB member who was able to attend during the very inconvenient time of midday, when it's at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, was cut off after 3 minutes, was not allowed to finish his remarks. The council welcomes feedback, therefore it is recommended the city council request the CPRB members provide the ad hoc budget crisis committee with input on the development and implementation of the auditor city council model. And the input they'll give, of course, will be, it's, you can't do it, it's too expensive, and that will be ignored, and they'll put up a pseudo auditor model. This is my prediction. Fiscal impact, restructuring the CPRB is expected to save approximately $60,000 annually in direct costs and approximately $15,000 to $20,000 in indirect costs. And this is submitted by Mayor Smiley Riley, the mayor, Scott Kennedy, the vice mayor. This is the man who originally crippled the board and produced a weak board way back in 1994. And Tim Fitzmaurice, the recycled Green Party council member who can't seem to find his way to keeping faith with the Green Party state platform on homeless civil rights. Not a good news to give you at the end of the show, but news that you should know. We have about 3 minutes left in the show, and I'm going to kind of pack it in. We'll be coming back again on Thursday, which I usually do, assuming I'm still about. Tomorrow is Merry Monday, if it isn't raining. It may be raining. If it isn't, we'll be down there at Cooper and Water Streets. Make that Cooper and Pacific. But Water's a little further over. Downtown in front of the Cinema 9, O'Neill's, that fine store that provides you with an additional line of sandals, you know that? Much needed instead of the old space-taking Cooper House with its foolish musician crowds and things of that sort. And we have a new downtown Santa Cruz that we're looking forward, and a stronger police department. Merry Monday starts at 3:30, goes usually till 5:30 or 6. This is wartime, folks. The State of the Union address is coming up with the Führer apparently moving forward on the war front, although he's getting opposition from France and Germany, and even anxiety from Tony Blair in England, who talks about wanting the inspections to continue. But they are going to raise whatever issues they can, and we have to do something immediate. I would suggest citizens demanding that the Santa Cruz be declared an open sanctuary for those who want to resist the war. Make it into, and encourage every other city in this country to do the same thing. That's at least an idea that came up today that I think is an excellent one. I proposed human shields and a delegation to Iraq, but that's too complicated, too expensive, too time-consuming, too far away, and it's already being done by the human shield group heading through Europe today, even as we speak. I believe there's probably a meeting of Iraqi peace action this evening. I don't have the details on it. If anybody wants to call in about it, they can. I know that I haven't heard a report from SUP, Standing United for Peace, the student group that meets every Friday at 7 o'clock up at the third floor of the Bay Tree Conference Center, and I'm hoping I can hear more about that on Thursday or maybe before. I don't know if we're going to have till Thursday, and I suppose everybody will show up at the town clock with a sign once they start bombing, thank you very much. I think, again, we need to show up now. And I was very pleased to see people walking around downtown on Friday night with signs, one or two of them. One woman, actually, is what I saw, with a sign that said, you know, stop the bombing or some such thing, which usually it's only me and my little flyers. It's good to see other people doing that, too. We need to do it, folks. For those who want to set up a 24-hour vigil and do something around that idea of a permanent protest downtown until this war is called off, give a call to 423-4833. That's the phone number of HUFF, 423-HUFF, 423-HUFF. You can also come to the City Council meeting at the 7 o'clock session. I probably will be there as they kill the Police Review Board. That's day after tomorrow. And then on Wednesday morning, it's the HUFF meeting at Baker's Square. That's at 8:30 in the morning at 1107 Ocean. Free coffee if you can't afford it. Come on down. I want to thank you for being with me on this edition of Bathrop's Piers Broadsides. We're going to go out on a little weirdness here for a change. This is from, it's called 2001, A Spoof Odyssey. It's from Forbidden Broadway, which is, for all you musical buffs, those who like satires, this is a satire of Broadway shows. Enjoy, and give me a call off times, 423-HUFF. Thanks for being with me. See you next time.
Forbidden Broadway 2001. Get out your phaser and laser gun. The future's here and it's awfully fun. Forbidden Broadway in 2001.
Tomorrow's here, but it's rather strange. The shows on Broadway don't seem to change. The same old war horses run and run.
Forbidden Broadway in 2001.
Swoosh, whoosh, Zeeble Monty gets stripped.
Zap, zonk, Zeeba Bossy gets tripped.
Ouch, who will lift Bernadette's face?
Aida gets creamed and binned into space.
We'll contact by radio. Erase their soundtrack and steal their show. Then launch them into oblivion.
Forbidden Broadway in 2001.
Bang, boom, Copenhagen gets nuked.
Yikes, yow, Dr. Jekyll gets spooked. We'll cut Heather Headley in half.
And channel the force, of course, for a laugh. Forbidden Broadway, Forbidden Broadway, 2001.
To the new corporate world of Broadway. Our first stop's the American Airlines Theater on 42nd Street. In order to make your flight a little more comfortable, we'd like to go over a few of the safety procedures you will find necessary in order to enjoy theater presented by big corporations. First, look around and notice the exits nearest you. These exits will be useful in case you need to make a mad dash during a slow number. Flotation devices have been placed under your seat should the actors appear to be in over their heads. Should the show just plain stink, an oxygen mask will be lowered from the ceiling. Place it over your own nose and mouth. Breathe normally and wait till the show's over. Lastly, should the show explode and go down in flames, please assume the flop position. Come fly with me, let's cry and cry. And throw black flags away. Thank you.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Dame Judi Dench. Thank you. You know, whenever I come to New York and go to the theatre, I can't help but notice. Why can't Americans do theatre like the Brits? Our avalanche of talent is crushing you to bits. If you did a Chekhov play as English actors do, you might win a Tony or two. With Peter Hall and Trevor Nunn and Maggie Smith for starters, you've lots of Kelsey Grammers, Cheryl Ladds and Dixie Carters. Most of your actors need a laugh track on the set. Oh, why can't Americans go and get some decent training in London, at RADA, or at the RSC? Just look what wonders it has done for me. When I read a phone book, New Yorkers completely burst with glee. Why, in Hollywood, they absolutely pee. Why can't Americans do theatre like the Brits? When George C. Wolfe does Shakespeare, Sir Kenneth Branagh shits. Rich theatre-goers love my royal rounded tones. Americans don't notice if I'm actually acting or not as long as I do it with an English accent. We British can do anything once we've gotten our diploma. We even beat Americans, reviving Oklahoma. Our shows are better even though we're snobby twits. So import your theatre. Or do your theatre like the Brits. Thank you.
Folks, listen. May I have your attention, please? Attention, please. I'm happy to be here, friends, back on the boards with this routine. I'm the actual Robert Preston, not the imitation now in question, and I'm here to talk about the contemporary theater scene. Well, you got trouble, my friends. Right here, I say trouble, right here in New York City. Why, sure, I'm a theater-goer, certainly mighty proud to say it. I'm always mighty proud to say it. I consider that the hours I spend at a Broadway show are golden. Help me cultivate culture and a sense of humor and dramatic flair. But just as I say it takes judgment, brains, and maturity to make a good Broadway show, I say that any boob can pull a two-bit play in a theater. And I call those flops. The first big shows of the year are leading to degradation. I say first, it's Little League Tomlin at the booth, then Cher at the Schubert. And the next thing you know, your tickets are costing more money than at Citibank. Cause production costs are out of control. To produce is not an art, it's more like gambling. And the only shows in the black are the shows they show on HBO. Like to slap down $80 when you're going to watch Sex in the City? Make your blood boil? Well, I should say. Now, friends, let me tell you what I mean. You got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 quality productions, but none of them from this season. And nothing much coming up. And that ends with P, and that rhymes with D, and that stands for dull. Now, I know all you folks are lovers of the theater. I'm gonna be perfectly frank. Would you like to know what kind of conversation goes on at a typical Sardi's lunch? People talk about Contact, talk about Fosse, talk about Riverdance Swing and Mamma Mia. And jeer it all about how's about the only shows now are big dance concerts one fine night. We'll walk down Broadway looking for a good show to go to, but I'll be gone. And all that you'll hear is hip-hop, shameless music from a big hotel, high-rise with MTV and DVD players, mass media, frenzy idol theater. There's a devil's playground. Trouble?
Oh, we got trouble.
Right here in New York City.
Right here in New York City.
With a capital T, and that rhymes with D, and that stands for dull.
That stands for dull.
We surely got trouble.
We surely got trouble.
Right here in New York City.
Right here.
Gotta figure out a way to get this Broadway season out of its law.
This Broadway season's really in trouble.
Theater goers of America. Heed that warning before it's too late. Look for the telltale signs of Broadway's destruction. Are the new Ethel Merman and Mary Martin, Rosie O'Donnell and Kathy Lee Gifford? Are orchestras so heavily mic'd that they might as well play a tape? And do? Are foreign actors creeping into our Broadway theaters? Actors like Juliette Binoche? And Jesus Christ, stupid star. Well, if so, my friends, you got trouble.
Oh, we got trouble.
Right here in New York City.
Right here in New York City.
With a capital T, and that rhymes with D, and that stands for dull.
That stands for dull.
We surely got trouble.
We surely got trouble.
Right here in New York City.
Right here.
Remember Mame, Hello Jolly, and Kajafor.
This Broadway season's really in trouble.
Oh, we got trouble. We're in terrible, terrible trouble, because Broadway looks like it's heading for an artistic law.
Artistic law.
We surely got trouble, trouble, trouble.
Oh, yes, we got trouble here. We got big, big trouble.
With a T.
Got
a rhyme with D.
That rhymes with D.
That stands for dull.
That stands for dull.
Oh, where are you? you going? Says Miller to Munger. We may not tell you, says Johnson to Judd. We're going to mill, says Jack to our jail. We're going to the factory, says little Ned Ludd. And what will you do there, says Miller to Munger? Do you swear to tell no one, says Johnson to Judd? We'll break the machinery, improve the scenery, meet in the greenery after, says Ludd. And how will you break 'em, says Miller to Munger? Stick with us, we'll show you, says Johnson to Judd. With pikes and with hammers, with fire and spanners, to teach 'em some manners, says General Ludd. Die, die, die-de-dum, die-de-dum, die. 'Cause and if we don't break 'em, our lives they will take 'em, our craft, our cottage, our village as well. No freedom or laughter for those who come after, but a servant and master in a factory hell. So the door was kicked in, and the frames were all broken, and the owner was woken and raised the alarm, and the yeoman came riding, but we were in hiding, the people providing to keep us from harm. From Notts up to Lancashire, Yorkshire to Derbyshire, 1811 to 1813, Ludd's army enlisted and the people resisted the march of a more money-making machine. Die, die, die-de-dum, die-de-dum, die. How now shall we stop it, says owner to roller, with spies and with soldiers, says Tory to Whig. We'll hang every breaker and Luddite oath taker, transport troublemakers, and that's what they did. 14 hung on a beam, ugliest justice that you've ever seen. 50 in all who took a long fall in the rising against the machine.